Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things in the world. Doing a podcast a bit early today because I've got to go out soon. I just thought it'd be better to do it early rather than super late. So it's only 7 p.m. Can you believe that? And I'm awake for once-ish, kind of awake. It's about as awake as I get. Let's just put it that way. We're talking about. Computer's giving me all kinds of notifications. Not now, computer. We're talking about part 3, chapter 13 of Anna Karenina. He shouldn't be unhappy, but she shouldn't be happy. What do you think of Karenin's decision? Megamuncher says, as much as I've been enjoying Levin's chapters and the storyline between him and Kitty, it's nice to go back to the Anna story, and it seems that it's starting to get more tense. I think Alexei's decision is one I expect of him, given what we know about him so far. The opinions of other matters a lot to him. The opinions of others matters a lot to him. So it's reasonable to assume he'd still try to keep up appearances. I wonder how this will change with the pregnancy, though. I Am Norwegian says, my translation uses the word unhappy in place of suffer. I thought it was a little funny how naive that line of thinking was. When I read it, I heard the Arrested Development narrator going, he could be unhappy, in my head. Alexei's logic here is awfully convenient. He latches onto religion again because it suits his purposes at the moment. It allows him to avoid embarrassment in the name of spiritual reform and mercy. Though I understand how he suddenly is able to wash his hands of his wife. I can't remember her words, but I do remember that they were very cruel. Tekrific says, unlike Menelaus in the Iliad, Alexei has no means to go to war, and Anna, however beautiful, is no Helen. He considered a duel several chapters ago, but he cowed to his inner fear. I Am Norwegian called him a coward, if I recall. We are forced to concede the truth of that statement, whether we think duels are ridiculous or not. Instead, his recourse is reflective of his inner coward. The only way he can win is to make the injuring parties, Anna and Vronsky, suffer. Concealing what has happened is the politician in him. He could have benefited from reaching in and plucking out his inner diplomat, but that his ego won't allow, and his pride couldn't sustain. Status quo is the punishment of the weak. Oh dear. Well, he's in a bit of a catch-22, really, isn't he? Because he's in a bad situation, and there's no way to get out of it and be like, woohoo, I did it. Like, you've got a bunch of bad options. And, I think he's found himself at a stalemate, and so he's just figured, do nothing. I certainly wouldn't be doing nothing. But then, yeah, the roadblocks are doing any of the other things, getting his divorce or whatever, or having a duel. They're all, you know, pretty real back then. You know, a duel is like, I might die. So, like, it's fair enough to not want to do that. The divorce is going to reflect poorly on him as well and potentially damage his career. So, also not good. And it's also very difficult to do because you need proof of the adultery, which, you know, that's not easy to come by in that time and place, really. He's playing it out, seeing what happens, sort of, in a way. Anyway, that's the discussion for chapter 13. Not much of a discussion today, but that's all good. Sorry, I'm just reading another message, but it's not related, so I'll skip that one. All right, let's read chapter 14. By the time he reached Petersburg, Karenin had not only resolved to keep to his decision, but had mentally composed a letter to his wife. On entering the hall of his house, he glanced at the letters and papers which had been sent from the ministry and ordered them to be brought into his study. Tell him to unharness and no one is to be admitted, he said in answer to the hall porter's inquiry, accentuating with a certain pleasure the word admitted. It was a sign that he was in good spirits. He paced twice up and down his study and then halted at a gigantic writing table on which his valet had already lit six candles. Cracking his fingers, he sat down and arranged his writing materials. With his elbow on the table and his head bent to one side, he sat and thought for a minute and then wrote without an instant's pause. He did not begin by addressing her and wrote in French, using the plural pronoun you, which in French does not sound as cold and distant as it does in Russian. During our last conversation, I expressed my intention of communicating my decision with reference to the subject of that conversation. Having carefully and fully considered everything, I now write to fulfill my promise. My decision is as follows. Whatever your actions may have been, I do not consider myself justified in severing the bonds with which a higher power has united us. A family must not be broken up through the caprice, perversity, or even crime of one of the married couple. And our life must go on as heretofore. This is unavoidable for my sake, for yours, and for that of our son. I am perfectly convinced that you have repented and are repenting of the action which has led to this letter, and will completely cooperate with me to eradicate the cause of our discord and to forget the past. If not, you can yourself foresee what awaits you and your son. I hope to talk all this over with you in more detail at a personal interview. As the summer season is drawing to a close, I would ask you to return to Petersburg as soon as possible and not later than Tuesday. All necessary preparations shall be made for your return. I beg you to note that I attach importance to this request of mine. A. Karenin. P.S. I enclose some money which you may need for your expenses. He read the letter over and was satisfied with it, especially with having remembered to enclose the money. There was not a single cruel word or threat in it, yet it was not yielding in tone. Above all, it provided a golden bridge for her to return by. Having folded the letter, smoothed it out with a massive ivory paper knife, and put it and the money in an envelope, with the pleasure that the use of his well-arranged writing appliances always caused him, he rang. Give this to the messenger and tell him to take it to the country to Anna Arakteyevna tomorrow, he said, and got up. Yes, Your Excellency, shall tea be served in the study? Karenin assented, and toying with his paper knife went to his armchair, beside which a lamp was burning and a French book about the Eugubine tables was lying ready. Above the armchair hung a beautifully painted portrait of Anna by a celebrated artist. To Karenin, the splendid painted black lace on the head, the black hair, and the beautiful white hand with many rings on the third finger suggested something intolerably bold and provocative. After looking at the portrait for about a minute, he shuddered and his lips trembled and made a sound like brr as he turned away. He sat down hurriedly and opened his book. He tried to read, but could not awaken in himself the lively interest he had felt for the Eugubine tales. Eugubine. His eyes were on the book, but he was thinking about something else. He was not thinking of his wife, but of a complication that had recently arisen in his official activity and at present constituted the chief interest of his work. He felt that he now saw more deeply than ever into that complication, and that a capital idea, he might say, that without flattering himself, had occurred to him, which would disentangle the whole business, raise him in his official career, upset his enemies, and therefore be of the greatest value to the state. As soon as the footman who had brought in the tea had left the room, Karenin rose and went to the writing table, drawing himself toward himself the portfolio of current affairs with a scarcely perceptible smile of self-satisfaction. He took a pencil from the stand and became absorbed in reading some intricate papers he had sent for, relating to the impending complication. The complication was this: Karenin's official peculiarity, his characteristic trait, every successful official has his special trait, which together with his determined ambition, self-restraint, honesty, and self-confidence had made him successful, consisted in a contempt for red tape, a curtailment of correspondence, economy, and as far as possible a direct relation with real facts. It so happened that the important committee of June 2nd had brought before it the question of irrigation in the Tsarist province, which belonged to Karenin's department, and presented a striking example of unproductive expenditure and useless red tape methods. Karenin knew that this was really so. The field irrigation of the Tsarist province had been started by the predecessor of Karenin's predecessor, A great deal of money had been and was being spent quite unproductively on that business, and it was evident that the scheme would lead to nothing. When Karenin had first taken up his present post, he had at once realized this and had wished to stop it, but till he felt himself firmly seated, he knew that it would not be wise to do so, as too many interests were involved. Afterwards, being occupied with other matters, he had simply forgotten the business. Like all such matters, it went on by itself, by inertia. Many people lived by it, especially one very moral and musical family in which the daughters all played stringed instruments. Karenin was acquainted with that family and gave away one of the daughters to at her marriage. The raising of this question by a hostile department was, in Karenin's opinion, dishonest, because in every ministry there were still graver matters, which out of recognized official decency, no one ever questioned. But since the gauntlet had been thrown down, he would take it up boldly and would demand the appointment of a special committee to investigate and report upon the work of the Committee of the Irrigation of the Saris Province, but at the same time he would not yield an inch to those gentlemen who had raised the question. He would demand the appointment of a special committee to inquire into the case of the subject races in that province. The case of the subject races he had been accidentally raised at the committee of June 2nd, and had been energetically insisted on by Karenin as a matter of urgency in view of their wretched condition. At the committee, this question had caused conflict between several ministries. The ministry opposed to Karenin had argued that the condition of the subject races was most flourishing, and that the projected rearrangement might destroy their prosperity, while, if there was really anything unsatisfactory, it all resulted from the neglect by Karenin's department of the measures prescribed by the law. Now Karenin meant to demand first that a new commission should be formed to investigate locally the conditions of the subject races. Secondly, should those conditions prove to be such as they appeared to be from the official reports already received, that another scientific commission should be appointed to study the causes of this deplorable condition of the subject races in the following aspects: A. Political, B. Administrative, C. Economic, D. Ethnographic, E. Material, and F. Religiously. Thirdly, that information should be demanded from the hostile department concerning the measures it had taken during the last 10 years to avert the unfavourable conditions to which the subject races were now exposed, and fourthly, that the department in question should be required to explain why it had acted in direct contradiction to the meaning of the Fundamental and Organic Law Volume - Article 18 and footnote to the Article 36 as appeared from the statement submitted to the committee and numbered 17015 and 18308 of 5th of December 1863 and 7th of June 1864. A flush of animation suffused Karenin's face as he rapidly wrote out a summary of these ideas. Having covered a sheet of foolscap paper, he rose, rang, and sent off a note to his chief secretary asking for some necessary references that had to be looked up. After walking up and down the room, he again looked at the portrait, frowned, and smiled contemptuously. He once more took up the book of the Eugubine tables, and having reawakened an interest in them at 11 o'clock, went to bed, and when he lay there he remembered that what had occurred with his wife. It no longer appeared to him in such gloomy colours. Alright, there we go. Another chapter down. I think Tolstoy is trying to get us to hate Karenin. Right? Like, I was sympathising with the guy until just now, when he bored me to death. And now I'm Team Anna again, because, yeah, I'd leave that guy too. As soon as it starts saying, like, A, economic, B, whatever it says, ethnographic, C, you know, I'm out. I'm not reading a textbook here. I'm trying to read a novel. Right? And power to Tolstoy. He's trying to get me to be bored to death of this character. Mission accomplished. Doesn't take me long. I hope you liked that chapter. Have your say over on the subreddit. Thanks for listening. I really liked Simply Productive's sign-off on, I think it was yesterday's podcast, where she wasn't sure whether to say good evening, have a good night, good morning, whatever. So she just said, have a wonderful existence. So please do have a wonderful existence, and I'll see you tomorrow.